The Virginia Voice presents What's Your Story? Our program is based on the idea that everybody has a story to tell. All you have to do is ask. Now, here's the host of What's Your Story, Don Dale.
Hello, and welcome once again. My guest this time on What's Your Story is Evram Dou, co-owner with his sister of Sub Rosa Bakery at 25th and Jefferson in Churchill, which opened in December of 2012. And Evram, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We're going to start with the same question we always ask, and that's, what's your earliest childhood memory?
Wow. Well, I would say that my earliest childhood memory is licking the inside of a yogurt wrapper. There used to be, I don't know if they still have them, but a particular type of yogurt that had a foil, tin foil top. I remember peeling it back and licking, not just eating the inside, but, you know, licking the top.
How old were you?
I have no idea. I know it's my own memory because there's no pictures and nobody else has that memory of me doing that. So I guess at least 4 years old, maybe 5 years old.
Do you remember where you were? Where? What city?
Oh, I would be, yeah, you know, it was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which is where I was born, at home, and probably as a kid, you know, being able to, the first time being able to reach into a refrigerator and grab a little container of yogurt. You know, with Turkish heritage, we eat a lot of plain yogurt, but I think this one was vanilla or banana.
Uh-huh. You say Turkish heritage. Your parents were from Turkey.
That's correct.
And Istanbul?
Yeah, my mother was born in Istanbul, my father in Ankara, and they both came at very different times. My mother when she was 5 years old, and my father when he was about 26. So very different stages in their lives. But they met in Pittsburgh.
We should mention that we're sitting in the bakery, and so you can hear noises as customers come in looking for something good to eat. And it's a wood-fired bakery.
That's correct.
We'll get to that in a minute, because okay. I want to know more about that. But back to Pittsburgh and then Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
How long did you stay in Baton Rouge?
Well, until I was 11 years old, which, you know, was 1994, we ended up moving to Reston, Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C.
Why did you move?
Well, it was my parents' decision, so I was just 11 at the time. For me, it was an adventure. But my mother was a school teacher, and my father was a restaurateur. My sister and I grew up in the restaurant business.
Aha.
And so they were looking for an area which had both good schools for my mother and for us. My sister and I were both still in grade, you know, I was in middle school, she was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And also a metropolitan area that my father could open a restaurant in. So they were looking around for that. And we have family in Ohio. So Washington, D.C. area seemed to fit the bill on a multiple levels. So they moved us up there.
So you come by being a baker because of your family's business.
You know, in part, I guess, you know, you can never deny your blood, either partly or completely. I told my father when I was 13, I vowed that I wouldn't take over his restaurants and that I wouldn't be opening a restaurant. And I actually, you know, didn't study, didn't go to culinary school. I'm completely self-taught as a baker, as is my sister, although we did grow up in the restaurant business and we grew up working for my father.
Well, where did you go to school? Where did you study?
I went to Virginia Commonwealth University here in Richmond, Virginia, which is how I came to Richmond in the first place. And that was in 2001.
Uh-huh.
And I studied film first, photography, yeah, for 1 year only. And then, you know, I decided it really wasn't for me. And so I looked at the course offerings and I just chose the four or five best classes that I could imagine taking. And a lot of them happened to be religious studies classes. So I ended up getting one of my majors in religious studies. The other one was in women's studies, and the whole degree was called interdisciplinary studies. So I ended up studying a a variety of things, you could say.
Which prepares you for everything and for nothing.
Yeah, exactly. People would ask me, what are you going to do with the degree? And I said, well, it comes in a hard cardboard case. I can use it to scrape the ice off my car in the wintertime.
Well, how did you come to be a self-taught baker? And how did you teach yourself that?
I guess you could say, first of all, I kept finding myself in kitchens. I interned at a school in England, a co-ed boarding school, and I ended up teaching the baking class there and working in the kitchen and in the garden. I mean, that was where my interest was, but I also just seemed to be drawn there and kind of fit there. So I was more interested in alternative forms of education in the beginning. But as I started discovering baking in the home, on the home front, it became a hobby and I became a very avid home baker. And there's many forums online and many home bakers who are extremely passionate to the point where they pour tons of time and money and energy into what is essentially a hobby because it's not their full-time job. At first, it really was just a hobby, and then a few people said, you know, I would buy bread like this. Like, I was making so much bread, I had to give it away. Uh-huh. So a few people said that, and it got the wheels turning. And that was in 2009. And by that time, I had worked in a few different places, but never in a bakery. The only time I ever worked in anything close to a bakery was a pie factory when I was in high school. And I only wrapped pies and sold them to people. I didn't actually make them. So,
do you remember the first time you sold a loaf of bread?
I do. It was actually to a friend of mine who worked at Cuba Cuba here. He said, yeah, I'll even just swing by your house and give you $5 or something for a loaf. And I felt very awkward, actually, the first time taking money for this thing that I loved to do. It was a very strange feeling. And I had a friend at the time, he was traveling in France, but we spoke over the phone, and he had this idea of doing a bread CSA, which, if you're not familiar with CSA, it means community-supported agriculture. Farmers get paid up front, and then they deliver week after week after week vegetables. Well, his idea was, why not do a CSB, essentially, where people pay you a month or a subscription for a certain amount of time, and then they pick up their bread week after week after week. Well, that's how Seb Rosa got started.
Did you ever use that business model?
We did. For the first 2.5 years before we were a brick and mortar storefront, I actually baked out of my father's wood-fired pizza oven in Northern Virginia and would drive the bread to the Richmond Farmers Market.
And that worked out?
Well, it was very hard to make a living that way because it was really just one long bake a week. I would make about 90 to 100 loaves, depending on the week. And I had about, I would say, 60 to 65 subscribers. So those were core people who came every single week to pick up their bread. And they didn't have a choice of bread. They only had a choice of size. So they could either get a 1.5-pound loaf or a 3-pound loaf. But I did this for a year, for 16 months, I did this with a friend of mine who has gone on now to open his own bakery in Pittsburgh, funny enough, to bring it full circle in that way. And 16 months I did it alone. So it was us kind of, we split after a time because I wanted to stay in Richmond and he didn't want to be here. So then I just focused on Richmond after that. He was in Charlottesville.
Were you focusing on bread alone or did you do pastries at that point?
Zero pastries. And in fact, my sister, I mean, to tell the story in retrospect, it really seems like, you know, by the seat of our pants, which it was. I mean, everything happened both very organically, you know, just kind of occurring as things develop. But it also was very exciting for that reason, and it pushed us to work very hard to I can't even say master, but to this very day, keeps pushing us to care a tremendous amount about how we're doing what we're doing and what the each part of the process that we're participating in. Because at the end of the day, we don't have we have a diverse menu, but it is relatively focused for compared to other bakeries.
Yes.
So that hasn't changed. But my sister came on very late in the game, after I was doing this alone and after I found this particular space that we're sitting in. Then she was working at managing my father's restaurant in Washington, D.C., and I pitched her the idea. I basically said, I have this wood-fired oven, and I bake bread in it, but then we're going to have all this heat, this residual heat, left over with nothing to do. It really makes sense for a wood-fired bakery to have a variety of products that can take advantage of the type of heat, because you always have the strongest heat in the beginning part of the bake, and then it falls and falls and falls throughout the bake. So it necessitates that you work around it. It's very much a living beast in that way, not a dial or any buttons that you have to, you know.
You're really close to, well, what are you close to? You're close to the original way of making bread. You're close to the bread itself.
Yeah. The added aspects to the wood-fired oven element is a lot of bakers now are, especially small, you know, very, very small craft bakeries like ours, have their own mills like we do, and are milling flour, milling their own grain on a medium-sized scale, you know, not a huge scale, but enough for their own production, which is what we do. Our oven was built by this company at the time who had made some changes that were, you know, very different in some ways and allowed for production style baking, but also didn't, you know, break the bank with it.
It's like a freestanding thing
house,
within your building.
Yeah, it's a house.
It's made of brick.
It has a better foundation than, I can't say better. This has withgone a fire, but yeah, it has its own, you know, concrete slab foundation. We had to get the whole thing inspected from the ground up like that.
What's the volume inside? How many loaves of bread can you put in at once?
Well, it's essentially 2 4-foot by 6-foot ovens, one stacked on top of the other. And so in terms of a pound and a half loaf, you could probably fit about 48. And we do kilo-sized loaves now, so you can probably fit about 40 total in both decks if you were filling them at a time. So, you know, the biggest bake that we'll do is about 4 sets of 4 loads like that, so around 150, 160 breads. But we're also baking, you know, over 200, 300 pastries in that time too, on our busier days.
We're talking with Evrim Doe, who is the co-owner with his sister of Sub Rosa, and we're sitting in his shop at 25th and Jefferson Street in Churchill. You opened the shop in December 2012.
That's right.
And you had a fire.
That's right.
Right away. Not in the oven, but outside the oven.
No, outside. It was started by a cigarette. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. A tenant at the time.
And 9 months later, you reopened again.
9 months later, we reopened. You know, mid-January of 2014.
Who starts the fire every day?
Well, I will in a little bit after this be going to start the fire. We start
for tomorrow.
That's right. So everything works in larger cycles in any bakery really, but in a bakery like ours specifically. So we're milling the flour that we're going to use tomorrow in the dough that is going to be baked the next day, and we build the fire the day before for the breads and pastries that will then be baked the next day. So these ovens, they are an ancient type of oven. They're called retained heat ovens, meaning that you're actually just heating the masonry. You're heating up the bricks, and then you're cleaning out the ashes And it's the bricks, you know, the radiant heat combined with, you know, it has its own convective heat and the surface heat. All those three types of heat all go into baking whatever you put in there.
How long between the time you start the fire and when you can put the first loaf of bread in?
So our fires are generally anywhere from 4 to 6 hours in the evenings. So let's say we started at 3:30 today, or 4. Then it'll burn until we break it down to coals at about 8. So we'll feed it throughout that time. And then by about 8 p.m., it'll be a bed of coals. Then we'll let that mellow out until maybe it'll take an hour and a half, to be small enough coals that we can close up the flues so that no heat is now, you know, leaving.
Right.
We seal up the oven like that. We leave it overnight, and then I'll come in at 5 in the morning, 5:30 the next morning. So about, 9? That's 9 or 10 hours later.
So it would make for a very long process.
That's
where
right.
You have to be here paying attention.
Exactly, and which is why we live upstairs. Both my sister lives next door, and I live right upstairs, right above the bakery.
So you can keep an eye on it without having to drive across town to do it.
Yeah, you have to.
And you mill your own flour, you say?
We do. The majority of the flour in the breads, and all of our quiche and tarts, are all of our cookies. The only thing that doesn't have that uses roller milled flour are croissants. Lightest.
What other pastries do you make? I mean, I'm familiar with
pretty much just named them all.
You left out the apple tart.
Right.
That's what got me here in the first place. Somebody said, you've got to go check out this place.
Yeah.
The apple tart is huge and very good.
Well, right now it's because it's always seasonal. The apples are done for the year, and we're on to berries. So we have strawberry and cream, and pretty soon we'll have blueberries and raspberries coming out, and then peaches and so on.
And quiches and...
Yeah, we do quiche and savory tarts as well. We only work in terms of the ingredients that go into the quiches or any of these tarts. We only use produce that we get directly from farmers in this area. So that means we work extremely seasonally and extremely regionally. We simply don't use it if it's not in season. So right now we'll get chard, and we're out of, nobody has Swiss chard, so we're using escarole. A lot of aspects of the bakery follow a very, I want to say not non-traditional, but actually very traditional model,
right,
where you don't have everything all the time, every day. And that has taken, it's a learning curve for some of our customers, but most people who come immediately get on some level that the value and quality that they're getting is what is important, and not so much the, you know, homogeneous, efficient kind of output of product X, Y, and Z that you see kind of ubiquitous throughout.
You know? Why did you call it Sub Rosa?
Well, we started as a subscription service that was...
Sub, I get it.
Secretive. Sub Rosa.
Oh, under the rose.
Exactly.
On the QT.
Exactly. On the down low. So we started that way, and people only found out about it through word of mouth, through an email list. And you could only get on the list. Well, you could only get the bread if you were on the list and if somebody else dropped out. Because it was a very small amount of bread we were making, and the demand was much bigger.
You get a lot of people coming in and saying, what kind of subs do you make?
Well, every so often, we definitely get that question. And that was something somebody, a few people brought up before we opened, and I said, you know, I like the spirit of the name is good enough for me. It'll live on. I thought about changing it, but it just seemed to really... match a lot of things, you know, the fact that we're working within the idea that we're sharing something intimate, unique, that when you get it, you get it. You're really here, you're part of something that is a kind of secret that should be cared for that way.
Well, now you've got, what, 1, 2, 3, 4 tables? 5 tables?
Yeah, not that many.
And every time I come in here, there are people having coffee and eating pastry and have you. So you're way beyond the subscription service.
That's right, yeah. Well, we've definitely grown to the point of being the kind of community-centered neighborhood bakery that we set out to be. And we really didn't ever want to, and nor is the level of production that we're capable of up to the level of most, you know, most bakeries in America make a lot more of everything than we do, and they do a lot more numbers-wise than we do. For us, we're always navigating that an interesting, I don't know, kind of shadow world, like where we're in, we're doing things in a production setting, but we're also doing them in a way that this could have been any village in the Mediterranean 200, 300 years ago.
What part of it don't you do? I mean, you make your own starter, I understand.
That's right. Well, the starter is fed, so the starter is just like any kind of live culture that you have to keep feeding to keep alive. So that is easy to make and then easy to maintain, just requires constant feeding. We mill our own flour, a lot of it, and we do everything by hand. You know, I guess we don't milk the cows, or we don't make the butter. We thought about doing that.
Really?
Yeah. And there was the only place we could find cream would have required us to essentially become a dairy. It was raw cream, so we couldn't use it.
So there's no hand churn in the back
somewhere. There's no hand churn in the back. Not yet.
But you say not yet. Is that something that's still in the back of your mind?
Kind of a joke, but I think that the direction we'd like to move in is we work already with a few farmers on a level where we contract with them directly to grow grain for us. And that's the direction I'd like to see us moving in more and more, is that whatever products that we're making actually reflect what is being grown here. And, you know, something you said earlier, it reminded me of, you said, you know, this is the way it's always been, or something like that. It's been made this way for a long time.
Right.
In a sense,
bread is so fundamental.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been with, as long as there's been civilization, there have been people making bread.
Of course. And one of the things that I jokingly say it, but it is real. This is our time machine. This is our ability to access a world of flavor and to represent what people thousands of years ago were eating, not even as a novelty, but because there is something really fascinating to me about being able to sit down at a table and have an amazing meal that essentially connects you, you know, in both directions through time. That's the quality that we refer to as timeless, is you might be eating something that speaks across, you know, generations in both directions. So it has this quality to it that can never grow old. And there's something very, very beautiful to that.
How did the neighborhood take it when you moved in? What did this place used to be before it was a bakery?
We've heard of many things. It was a Goodwill, like a thrift store, right. And then another type of thrift store. We heard it was a church, a pharmacy, which the Roosevelt across the street was also apparently a pharmacy. We heard that it was also, it was a barber shop, like a hair salon, right before we moved in. And it looked, there were stairs right here above where we are sitting. But I took those down, and none of this was here. The oven, of course, wasn't here.
Did the neighborhood, did they look at you askance? Did they know what you were doing right away?
Or? No, Church Hill is amazing. Very, very supportive neighborhood in general. And we have the district office right across the street here, and we've even had, you know, community sessions where we've talked about how the neighborhood has changed, and those who have lived here for 35 years, you know, I think that they look at some of the changes as being, you know, it's hard to feel like when things change really fast, well, what benefit is it bringing us who have lived here for
right.
so long?
Yeah, exactly.
So we're not, we are kind of aware of that, and we kind of have, again, it's one of those tight ropes that we walk, or we try to offer things at a both a price and a comfort level. People can walk in here and get things that don't require a huge commitment, both in terms of time or money, and yet they're hopefully getting nourished in a way that if they did go to some other chain, you know, restaurant or chain bakery, they might pay $1 less, but they're not going to feel the same way as they do if they get a flatbread here, or you know, even a good cup of coffee with organic milk, you know, or something like that. We have only received the positive. So if there has been negative feedback, that they've been very kind and remained quiet.
You sound very proud, as you should be, as any businessman who starts a small business should be. But there's something extra. I mean, you seem very intent on the value of what you're contributing. Is that accurate?
Well, I suppose that it's more like a way of pushing oneself to not be complacent or content ever with where you are. I mean, in a sense, we can always improve something, and we can always do it in a way which, you know, 100 years from now or 500 years from now, somebody looking back on it says that that's a good way of doing that. That is more my concern. I never, when I opened this place with my sister, I didn't want to open just another bakery, and that wasn't just a marketing term for me. For me, it was very important. There's so many food businesses, not only in Richmond, but everywhere. But Richmond particularly, there's a new restaurant, it seems, almost every week. And I feel it behooves all of us in this business to really make a stand. Like, what is different about you, really? And what are you standing for? I think that including an ethos in the products that you make should be talked about and should be part and parcel of opening a business. It's an uncomfortable. It takes so much energy just to do it in the first place, just to administrate and produce the product, that a lot of times that other part just, you know, it remains in the background. And I think maybe the way I'm talking might show you that I want to move it a little bit more in the foreground. What kind of flour and what kind of grain you use and who you get it from and how you treat that farmer should be kind of as much of the concern as, you know, how much your croissant costs and how tasty it is and how pleasurable it is. But on the one hand, we're making something that we want it to be a simple pleasure, and we want it to be a daily form of sustenance. So you can't just preach, or you can't say that to every single person who comes in. You have to hope that they taste something worthy, worthwhile. So that at least at the end of the day, I can say, well, I did my best, and I hope it was worthwhile.
And some people enjoyed what I made.
Exactly.
This whole philosophy behind your bakery is a fascinating idea to contemplate, and I appreciate your taking time out from your day.
Oh, I appreciate you coming to
talk to us.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Evrim Dogu, and he spelled it for me. His last name is spelled D-O-G-U, but the G is silent.
That's
so
correct.
It's Dogu, who is the co-owner with his sister of Sub Rosa, a wood-fired bakery at 25th and Jefferson in Churchill, which has been in business since December 2012, and I have become a regular customer. Thank you, Evrim.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining us on What's Your Story? I hope you'll join us next time on the Virginia Voice. I'm Don Dale. Goodbye.
You've been listening to What's Your Story with Don Dale. If you know somebody with a story to tell, Or if you'd like to tell your own story, telephone the Virginia Voice, 804-266-2477. And be sure to join us next time for What's Your Story? This is Charles Mink speaking, and this is the Virginia Voice.